call back and I said, you know, in a 600-word column, you can't educate people who couldn't even tell you where their damn state capital was. But it is always a delight for me to come up to Laurel. I feel like this is home. I've gotten so many friends here, and I deeply appreciate y'all asking me to come up. And I tell you what you do, you rejuvenate me, because I work among postmodern liberals, you know, and I sometimes get to the point where I think, you know, there's got to be a silver lining even to a nuclear war, because by God, so many people would deserve it. But so I come up here and I find out there are still decent, intelligent, good human beings, and it kind of gets my juices going again. I had to go to a friend's funeral of a friend's father today over at Hattiesburg, and so I missed good friend John Killian's speech, and I'm sorry, John. But I don't know if he told you about the difference between a Southern Baptist and a Northern Baptist. I know he just don't preach to you. Well, Brother Dave Gardner used to say that somebody would say, well, Brother Dave, what's the difference between a Northern Baptist and a Southern Baptist? Brother Dave said, well, the Northern Baptists say there ain't no hell, and the Southern Baptist says the hell there ain't. My friend's father was quite a fellow. In fact, he was born in Laurel, and he was Hutt Dunnigan, calling. Quite a football player back in the 20s. But my good friend Ralph told me a story about his daddy, and I'd like to share it with you because it's so very Southern. And Ralph said when he was a little boy, there was a farmer that lived down the road from their house who had a reputation for being pretty mean. And he called up one day and said, your dog killed one of my geese. So Ralph's daddy went down there, and it wasn't much to argue about because there was a dead goose and there was a dog with the feathers in his mouth. So Ralph's daddy told this guy, he said, okay, I'll pay for the goose. He said, how much you want for him? The guy said, $5. So Ralph's daddy gave him $5. And the guy started to leave, and Ralph said, where are you going with my goose? He's going to take the goose, but he took it back. So the farmer said to him, he said, if I catch your dog on my land again, he said, I'm going to shoot him. Ralph's daddy looked at him, he said, well, you go ahead and do that. And if nothing bad happens to you afterwards, he says, you'll know you did the right thing. I love that. That is so subtle. But tell you one more Dave Gardner story, and then I'll kind of get serious. Brother Dave tells a story about two friends. And one of the friends moved to Chicago, and he went up there, and in fact, he got involved in the numbers racket. This was in the days before the states shoved the mobs aside and took over the numbers racket. But anyway, this guy's just making money hand over foot, and he wants his friend to come up there. But he's a little scared about saying in a letter what he was actually doing, so he wrote his friend, he included a Greyhound bus ticket and a few dollars. He says, come on up. He says, money is growing on the trees. Come quick. So his friend thought, well, that's great. So he got on the bus and went up to Chicago and got off at the downtown terminal. And he started walking towards the address that his friend had given him. And he cut through Lincoln Park. It's a park there. And as he walked by this tree, he looked down and he saw a $50 bill laying on the ground. He looked at it and he said, I ought to pick you up. I'm not working my first day in Chicago. Brother Dave, I can't stop telling you. Brother Dave told another story about a guy signed into a hotel in New York, and he turned the thing back to the clerk. The clerk looked at him. He said, well, I know you're from the country, he said. And he said, I guess you can't write. He says, well, I know that's why you put an X down. The guy said, that's right. He said, well, tell me this. He said, why did you draw a circle around the X? The guy said, well, you don't think I'm going to register under my real name, do you? let me get a little serious now. You know, this, what I call the flag flap, is a much bigger thing than just us and the Confederate flag. There is a sort of concerted assault on the country, in the country, to deconstruct American history and sort of eradicate it. Various groups are doing it for various reasons. But that is a terrible, terrible thing to do. Psychologists now know that what makes a human being human is memory. You know, we've all seen the tragic circumstances when somebody gets Alzheimer's and they can no longer function. A human being cannot function without memory. And the same thing is true of a nation. Many, many wise people have said that, you know, nations which don't look to their ancestors will not take care of their posterity. Or if you don't know where you've been, you don't know where you're going. And that is a very dangerous situation. And I run into it, and I know you do, that just colossal ignorance of American history. It's just astounding. And college doesn't seem to make any difference. You know, I'm so old-fashioned, I'm such a dinosaur, that I've always thought there are two things you ought to be able to tell from conversation and just normal association. One is whether or not a person is a Christian, and the other is whether or not they've been educated, you know, institutionally educated. Well, that doesn't work anymore. You know, people come out of college education with college education and apparently don't know anything. I don't know how they do it. I never went to college. That's what saved me. But my daughter just finished college, and she had to do a little survey as part of one of her courses. 15 trivia questions on geography and history. Gave it to every several number of people off campus, students and professors. And the only person that got all 15 answers correct was me. You know, and there were questions like how many states were in the Union in 1945. She had senior college students who said 20, 23. She had PhD, head of a department. Couldn't tell you the name of the river that runs through London. Didn't know the state capital of New York. I mean, you know, the dumbing down of America is a real factor. And it's probably, you know, I know some of you are thinking, well, it made your career, Reese. I mean, you know. That seems smart by contrast. But we cannot allow this to go on. Because if people don't know who they are, they don't know who their ancestors are, they don't know what this country was founded on, they don't know what it started about. They don't know anything about the Constitution. They don't know anything about the Bill of Rights. You know, a lot of them think the Bill of Rights was written so that, you know, bar girls could dance naked. I don't think that's what George Washington had in mind. But it is really a serious, serious problem. We must know who we are, and we must know what works and what doesn't work. People who don't know history don't know that. They're always discovering things for the first time, they think. Excuse me. And finally, with history, you learn the fallibility of man. You learn that old biblical truth. Man is a fallen creature. No matter what he tries, he's going to foul it up. And that's a good antidote against utopianism. And utopianism is one of the most dangerous things that can infect human beings. It's when people start trying to build a perfect society, then they start getting to the point where they end justifies the means, and they don't care how many people have to kill to get this perfect society. You know, we've seen utopians in Russia, China, Germany, all of them, you know, were going to build a perfect society, and it cost millions and millions and millions of lives. I used to think when I was a kid that the founding fathers of this country were all geniuses. As I got older and I began to read American history and learn more about them, I discovered that's not true. Maybe Franklin and Jefferson were probably had genius IQs. The rest of them, just regular people. But the big distinguishing characteristic, and you can see this for yourself if you read anything that they wrote or any of their speeches, that is so strikingly in contrast to modern politicians, they were realists. They knew human nature. They knew human beings would be corrupted by power. They just knew it. And that's why they devised a system to try to frustrate as much as possible that grab for power. And today, I mean, you won't find any utopianists in their speeches. They never go around telling people they're going to have perfect health care or, you know, perfect this or perfect that. All they said was, you know, we're going to try to keep you free if you can do it yourself. But that's important. All that comes from knowing history. So specifically, though, those of us who are in the Confederate movement, let's look at our enemies and recognize that they are enemies. You know, one is the NAACP. They're like the March of Dimes. They have succeeded themselves out of business. Everything they tried, they've won the cases, they've won the law, that was their specialty, was the lawsuit. And so now they don't really have anything to do. And I think 8 or 7 years ago when they started this Confederate stuff, they were trying to think of some reason, you know, to keep it. And it's like the March of Dimes. They didn't go out of business. They said, well, let's find another disease. They came up with birth defects. But, you know, I think, and I don't think there's any point in talking to them. I mean, they know what they're doing, and they're not open to reason. So the thing to do is just ignore them. But you'll notice that when they first did that resolution, which said that the Confederate flag is the most odious symbol in the universe, and that surprised me because I didn't know that there were any black astronauts who had toured the other planets, or white astronauts for that matter. But anyway, nobody paid much attention to it. It was a few years later when the press began to take it up that it's now become a sort of an epidemic. And, you know, a sort of a national, in fact, crusade to get rid of all things Confederate, which had been sitting around in courthouses and stuff for nearly 100 years. All of a sudden now, they want to get rid of them. And I think the liberal press is, you know, and there is a liberal press. I mean, don't, that's not a cliche. I think a lot of those people, first of all, they don't have any background in history. Second of all, they don't care about history. And they think that they just want to do the politically correct thing. And the politically correct thing says, I'll take the damn flag down. You know, that's the easy thing for them to do. I kid some of my colleagues and I tell them, I said, you know, the problem with you white liberals are that you're really closet racist. I said, you people really do think black folks are inferior. And that's why you treat them in this paternal fashion. I said, us conservatives know them, and we'll argue with them. You know, that's how you compliment a person. That's how you treat a person as equal. You argue with him if you don't agree with him. If you do agree with him, fine. If you don't, you argue. But the white liberal, oh, no, it's going to offend them. Take it down. Take it down. Well, you know, it's true in this country that we try to protect minority rights, but it's also true that majority rules. You know, so why should... You cannot get to the point, if you get to the point in this country where you're going to say, anybody who comes forward and says, oh, I'm offended by this, and you say, okay, well, we'll censor that so you won't be offended, then you've opened yourself up and you'll get it from every direction. Every direction. Somebody will come along and say, I'm offended by the American flag. I'm a Native American. They stole my land. They killed my ancestors. I'm offended. Don't play it, you know. You'll find some people who are offended by the Christian cross. We're going to take those down. You know, we just have to go ahead and act like normal human beings, and real tolerance, instead of this phony tolerance people talk about. Real tolerance is when you tolerate things and people you disagree with. It's not tolerance if you're going to make everybody agree with you. You know, that's not tolerance. Real tolerance is to say, okay, I can understand. I can understand your viewpoint, you know, but I disagree with you. So, you know, we're in the majority, the flag stays up. If you get a majority, take it down. But we have to recognize that, we have to stand for something. We have to stand for principles. And we cannot, I don't think, as I said once in the column, a piece of cloth, even as beautiful a piece of cloth as that rebel flag, flying on a flagpole has no material effect on anybody's life. I mean, I cannot tell you what's flying from the top of the Florida Capitol. They may be flying the rainbow flag for all of them. They did in Orlando once. Gay Pride Month. I wrote a column. I said, I'm glad the mayor did that, because I'm sure now they're going to fly the Confederate flag during Confederate history. They quickly passed an ordinance that they'll never fly any flags anymore. But anyway. But so we have a problem with the liberal press. And they're very difficult to educate, mainly because they don't want to be. Colleges fail, so why should you succeed? The third group that's causing a lot of problems are us, white Southerners. Like Pogo Possum said, we've met the enemy and he is us. Who's taking down the flags? Not black people, it's white people. It's white Southerners. Who's taking it? Oh, yank it down. And how did this happen? How did we get to the point where most Southerners today don't want to defend their own heritage? And that heritage, has nothing to do with slavery. It has nothing to do with race. The heritage we want to preserve is a civilized society. It existed, a Christian society of Christian gentlemen and Christian women, a society that had families and empathy and conversation and sharing and caring and high standards of behavior. That's the part of the Southern heritage we're trying to preserve. Slavery was a product of the age. And as we all know, very few, relatively minor part of Southerners even owned slaves. As we also know, I was looking at a genealogy book the other day, and 1830 census listed 3,810 free blacks who also owned slaves in different states. So I don't think, so many people in America today are fixated on the race issue. I don't think history is a race issue. The great sin people commit is called presentism. They take today's knowledge, today's attitudes, today's politics, and they project it back into the past. And they judge those people by 20th century standards, which is patently unfair. Patently unfair. If you're going to understand history, you have to put yourself in their shoes, which means you have to forget what we know from hindsight. When we read history, we know how it's all going to turn out. They did not. And anybody who's involved in anything, they don't know how it turned out. They didn't know. I'm sorry that some people are fixated on race. Some people make a good living being fixated on race. And then I think white liberals try to salve their conscience by being fixated on race. But I don't see that the Confederate Heritage Organization, and that flag has anything at all to do with the race. The fact that the KKK has used it is no different from the fact that they've used the American flag and the Christian cross. I mean, if you don't like the KKK, go. Yep, I don't like them either. But we just need to move on and preserve our history. So let me close this up with a little bit of strategy, I think. How did we lose our culture? How did we get to the point where Southerners either don't know and don't much care about the past? How did we get to that point? Killian and I were talking about that today, and I think it was World War II. During World War II, America became a very nationalist country. Everybody pulled together. And Southerners have always been patriotic. They've always responded to the colors. And during World War II, really people stopped thinking in terms of North and South, I think for the first time. I know in Thompson, Georgia, where I was a kid, we had a we'd have soldiers home for Sunday dinner, and one day we got this young man from upstate New York, and after he left, we all had this big discussion because, you know, even though he was a Yankee, he was a very nice person. And no kidding, it was the very first Yankee I had ever seen. I guess I was about 7 or 8 years old. Very first one. I had moved to Texas, of course, before I saw a Catholic. And I was very disappointed that he didn't look like Pat O'Brien. You know. But I think it was during that war when America became so united in a common objective that sectional differences were really swept aside. And oddly enough, immediately after that, there was kind of a consensus. You know, Shelby Foote talked about it. And the general consensus was, well, the war was a tragedy. Slavery was a curse. The brave men on both sides deserve to be honored. We revere our southern ancestors, but in our heart of hearts, we're probably glad they lost because it preserved the Union. And that was kind of the post-war consensus. But now, the people who are attacking us are breaking that consensus. You know, if we're going to have the war all over again, then we have to, you know, readjust our thinking. And it's very difficult. I want to tell you, I had a terrible time adjusting to the fact in the last few years that I no longer liked nor trusted my federal government. And I say that in all seriousness. A man called me, he's an elderly man in Orlando, and he said that he had cleaned out his attic and he found a German submachine gun that he had brought home from the war. He had packed it away and forgotten about it. And he was concerned that when he passed on, you know, his children would find it, of course, and might get in trouble, and he asked my advice on what to do. Well, 20 years ago, I would have, without any hesitation, I said, there's no problem. Call the FBI or the ATF, and they'll tell you how to get the licenses, you know, legalize it, and you can sell it. When he asked me that, though, I could not in good conscience give him that advice anymore, because I've seen my federal government, my federal agencies, act in a very irrational and brutal manner. And for all I know, they run out there and arrest you. And that's sad that when you lose faith in your federal government. But I think we have to recognize that, you know, the government today is not the government of 50 years ago. And look at it as it is, and not as we imagined it is, or how it used to be, or how we wish it was, but just as it is. And when you look at it, it's a government that seems to be afraid of us, not just us Southerners, but of the American people. It seems to distrust us. And that's a very dangerous attitude for a government to have. So I think we need to begin to rethink that. And we need to recognize loyalty to principles, not to government. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, a Republican, but Teddy Roosevelt, he said, you should stand by a public official only to the extent and as long as he stands by the Constitution, and no longer. And that's, you know... That's what differentiates us from other countries, is that Constitution. You know, even our military and our public officials, they swear an oath to defend and protect the Constitution. And our loyalties are to the Constitution and not to the people who are occupying public office at any given particular time. You know, Jefferson Davis, he said, I love the Constitution and I love the Union, but I would rather leave the Union with the Constitution than stay in it without it. And that was, you know, that was the crux that caused the break. Was that the North had, and they said, I mean, you know, and it's in the historical record, Lincoln's people all around, they said, the Constitution's a bunch of crap. It's a sheet parchment. We're not going to pay any attention to it. And that's why the Southerners left. And we have to make that decision, you know. Are we going to stand by the Constitution, or are we just going to go with the flow? whatever the politicians in Washington say. We have kind of the same decision our forefathers had. It'll be interesting to see how we decide. I think we should stand by the Constitution. Robert E. Lee said there's true glory and true honor, the glory of duty done and the honor of integrity of principle. And I think that's what we need. We need to stand up for principle. We need to stand up for the Constitution. And we can do that through recruitment. We can do it through education. You know, we need to build support groups. We need to harass our enemies. And, you know, I don't mean slash their tires or anything like that. You know. But I'll tell you, it's a very effective technique. Every time the press prints something that is factually wrong about your group, you know, call them up. Complain about it. You know, I frequently in my columns lately, I criticize our relationships with Israel and our Middle East policy. Well, I can guarantee you, the Israeli lobby never, ever lets one single column go by because they don't complain to the editor. They come down, they write letters to the publisher. They write letters to me. They never let one single sentence go by that they don't respond. And that's very good because it conditions the reporters and the editors to realize, hey, there are people out there and they're paying attention. And, you know, my God, I'm tired of talking to them. You know, and you again, you, and they will respond. And we need to do the same thing. We need to do exactly what they did. Every time, you know, somebody crosses, every time somebody prints a factual inaccuracy or, you know, one of these editorials are going to condemn our ancestors and slander them. We need to come back at them. Come back at them. You know, be polite, be firm, be factual. But don't let it go by. Don't let it pass. And I think if we do that, we can change it. But I want to close with this point and why it's necessary for us to do that. You know, if you look at these little children in the audience, and most of us have grandchildren, you know, what kind of future are they going to have if we do nothing? The trend lines in this country today are toward an authoritarian government. I mean, and you can see it in the legislation Congress passes. You can see it in how routinely they disregard the Constitution. You can see it in their statements. You know, they do kick doors down in public housing projects and search people for guns without a warrant. As if, you know, if you're in public housing, you don't have constitutional rights. So if those trends continue, and they will if we do nothing, then our grandchildren are going to live in a totalitarian society. It may be, you know, mildly benign, but it will be an unfree totalitarian society. And as our forefathers recognize, anybody that has power can be corrupted by that power. And they may become not so benign. You know, people in Germany, if they thought Hitler was the greatest thing since snuff in 1934. Yeah, by 1945, they realized they'd elected a madman. And when he got ready to kill himself, he'd take the German people with him. So we need to think carefully about our grandchildren and think about the fact that they cannot do anything at all about their future. Because they're children. And their future is being constructed today. The future is always constructed in the present. And their future will depend on what we do in the political arena, in the press, you know, in our own lives, our own communities. Their future, we are now determining their future, us. And most of us, you know, will be gone by the time they get there. But it's still our responsibility. Our responsibility to give them a country that they can hold their head up in and be free. You know, I ran across a wonderful quote from Alvin York. Simple Southerner, so wonderfully typical. As you know, most of you know, he won the Medal of Honor in World War I, knocked out 5 German submachine gun toolboxes, captured 225
master and soul by himself. But he said, fear of God makes a hero. Fear of man makes a coward. And so I would just say to all of you tonight that all of us, you know, have to put aside our fear. As William Faulkner says, you know, it's poison to creativity. And step forth and start constructing a future for our grandchildren that they will be proud to say we provided for them. And so, you know, God bless you all. God bless you for being here. God bless you for being in this organization, because in doing so, you're making a statement. And I really enjoyed being with you, and I'll shut up and sit down. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Charlie. We certainly enjoyed that. Outstanding. At this time, I'd like to introduce Anthony Herbie. Anthony, if you would come up. I think most of you know about Anthony. He's a PhD candidate at Ole Miss, and he's got a very special project that he's been working on, and he wanted to address the banquet tonight.
How you doing? I want you to know I'm nervous as hell. What I'm nervous about is that not once in my life until now that I've seen so many wonderful white people in one room, in one gathering. I've been working on my project. I'm going to try to make a statement here and also talk about what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to do is actually attack cultural dependency. What I'm trying to do is eradicate in my community the victim status. Blame the white man. You know, that's the reason, you know, I pick up the battle flag and I actually march. All right. Can you hear me now? That's the reason I pick up the battle flag. I want people to know that I'm not picking this battle flag up for white people. I'm not picking it up for black people. I think the speaker addressed one issue about when you fear God, you get out there and do what needs to be done. A lot of people have asked me, have I got any death threats? I got a few, but I don't fear man. Now, my point is I'm going to bring up some things that I'm trying to do. First of all, I'm planning a march on Jackson. This march might take about 2 weeks. I'm trying to get at least almost 100 blacks together, black Confederate soldiers with ancestors, to march on Jackson. Now, some people may think this might be impossible. Some people may be thinking I'm crazy. But I'm here to tell you that it's going to happen. And the reason that it got to happen is that this divisiveness that white liberals and the black left have created, what I call the NAACP babies, have to stop. And the reason that it has to stop is that it's a lot of innocent people that have actually suffering. Now, I left the United States a long time ago. I seceded a long time ago. A lot of people out here saying about the government and he should participate. I'm a 34-year-old black man who had never voted. And the way things are going right now, I think I won't vote. Because there's nobody out there that actually speaking for the great state of Mississippi. We have health problems. We have economic problems. We're being taxed to death. Almost 49 cents of our dollar go to state, federal, and local. And you talk about taxation without representation? Look around at the great state of Mississippi. We have no industry. And yet and still, we have people that are constantly talking about get rid of the Confederate battle flag. I find it rather appalling what happened in the great state of South Carolina. But I think South Carolina deserves it. Why I think, let me make this statement. If you trust in your political system, if you trust Governor Musgrove to say, well, we're going to vote on this. Okay, say if the majority says, let's get rid of the battle flag. Just say in the great state of Mississippi they vote. And the Harrises actually leave. Are you going to leave? Stop waving the flag then? I'm not going to stop waving mine. I do not trust the political system the way it is set up right now. Now again, I must go back to cultural dependency and how racism is actually created. Racism is created by guilt. Let me give you an example. As a sociologist, I call it the liberal design. In our education system in the great state of Mississippi, we look at television shows like Mississippi Burning, Time to Kill, Rosewood, the History Channel. How many of you out there in the great state of Mississippi control Hollywood? Now, how many of you in the great state of Mississippi control the United States Board of Education? I said the United States Board of Education. They dictate what literature actually goes into the education system. Now, back to cultural dependency. And I wanted to also make an apology. I want to apologize to all you white people, good white people, not the bad ones. I want to apologize for the hate, for the animosity that has actually been instilled in me ever since I was a child. But it is your fault because you allowed it to be festered. And now we are actually reaping what is actually being given to us right now. Back to my apology. I always vowed to get all white people back. Back for I don't know what, a few movies, you know. But I want to apologize to you who out there, like my high school teacher, I really want to thank him. He actually, and I want to correct the media. I'm not a PhD candidate at the University of Mississippi. I was accepted at the University of Chicago to finish up my PhD. I actually studied at the University of London at Birkbeck. You know, I was just taking a few Spanish courses at the University of Mississippi. Now back to my apology. This apology is one of the reasons also that I picked up the battle flag. I've noticed the real racist is the one who don't pick up the battle flag. I've noticed this at the University of Mississippi. I'll give you an example. The University of Mississippi got rid of the battle flag, the Confederate battle flag, and we have what you call, I don't know, maybe it's a gang sign or M or whatever, I don't know. But we have the M sign. And the reason that they did that is to recruit what I call super bucks, super athletes. Okay, they got their super athletes. But yet and still, the University of Mississippi is last in graduating those black athletes in the SEC. Now, back to the apology. It hurts me every time I look at the Confederate battle flag because that Confederate battle flag reminds me of how stupid I used to be. Every time I hold it, the people who I abused, the Louis Farrakhan rhetoric that I used, the Jesse Jackson speeches that I manipulated, to make what I call real, honest white people feel very guilty. I do want to apologize for that. And that march on Jackson is one of the steps that I'm going towards that apology. Now, what you have to do is also understand what that march is including on your end. I was talking to one of my white Confederate brothers, you know, and I was telling him that it's all right to dress up in the Confederate battle flag and the outfit, and we get together and we reenact. But we don't need to just be reenact. We need to act. Because, see, this is a very serious thing that we're actually doing. It's all right to talk about history, but understand the history that you're actually making today. And I understand what I'm actually doing. They painted me in the press and on the radio as a moron, as a cuckoo. Nobody asked me anything. They even said that it was so insulting. These are your white liberals. They came to me and asked me, what white man have stuck his hand up my derriere and made me talk? How much money am I getting for this? I have the FBI approach me and told me I should watch out for Southern white people. Do not take any food or water from them. Any more steak out there? Now, I'm gonna go ahead and conclude this, but again, I want to say something what James Brown said in the 60s. You know, when he said he's black and he's proud. Well, today I stand in front of you and I say, I am a Confederate and I'm proud. I want to thank you for having me out. I want to make sure I thank this guy that I never thought we'd cross paths, and this is Greg Stewart. Could you stand up, Greg, please? I just want to make one statement. Greg and I we went to high school together, and I didn't like it. I mean, Greg in high school was what I call, he was pretty, and you know how we men, we don't like any other man that looks better than we do. So, but also what I didn't also I didn't like because he was white, and this was actually going on in our education system. I say about 10 years later, I saw the same Greg Stewart. We was in the shower. I mean, he was in the shower. my son, both of my sons, we were sitting there and we were talking, and Greg came by and he said, I haven't heard, is that you? I said, yeah, that's me. Hey, I know you. Start talking, and we little did I know that by meeting him that I would have an outlet for a lot of my anger and a lot of betrayal. You know, I've been a Confederate. When I was, I didn't know I was a Confederate. Do you know what I mean? You know when you know something is right and you know it, but you just can't pinpoint it. Well, a few conversations with Greg, and you know, we started to talk. And what I did is I saw that the Confederacy, that I had to get involved. So what I did is I understand the issue of how the white left has used race. So what I did is I went to the tattoo shop, And I got me a tattoo that had the Confederate battle flag. It's on my arm right here. And it says Black Confederate Soldier, and it says Mississippi First across there.